Today last, Secretary of Labor Arthur Goldberg announced to the American people 5.5 million American workers were idle. Translated, one in every 13 American workers is jobless. This is the highest level of unemployment which America has known since the short and sharp readjustment period at the close of the Second World War. It is a situation which has deteriorated rapidly. In the last 6 months, the number of the jobless has increased by 1,700,000, and the number of those employed has decreased by 1,200,000. Many reasons have been offered. Growing foreign competition, extended inventories, business recession. But all these offer little help and little comfort to the worker who is suffering the hardship of economic stringency. And when unemployment jumps rapidly, it is a matter of concern not only for the idled, but for the nation as a whole. Unemployment is the most serious cancer which a nation can suffer. It metastasizes through the whole body politic. Joblessness breeds violence, and it breeds crime, and it breeds delinquency, and it breeds alcoholism. It breeds family disorientation and disintegration, desertion and divorce. And if protracted and widespread enough, it breeds the Fuhrer demagogue, who wins from these industrial, jobless, emotional support for his gospel of economic salvation and his promise of sweet revenge against those who sabotaged, in his mind, the economy. Hitler, Mussolini, Peron, all the fascist dictators of our day recruited their militia from among the industrialized idle. Now, the American situation is not out of hand. There are, to be sure, 5.5 million without jobs. But 67 million Americans are employed, earning their living. But prudent men recognize the importance of preventive therapy, the early recognition of disease, of limiting the spread of the disease so that it does not become aggravated. And principled men recognize that even if the unemployment is chronic in only a few areas, even if as yet only percentage-wise a few among our American people are suffering real hardship, no society of abundance such as ours can tolerate that degree of hardship. America is based on the principle that extremes of wealth and extremes of poverty shall not exist side by side. And over the years, Americans have built into their political way of life many measures, many programs designed to mitigate the hardship of an economic recession, designed to give the jobless some income between jobs, designed to speed the trough so that we can put the economy back again on its feet. During the 1920, many states, and by the end of the 1930, all states had programs of unemployment insurance and unemployment compensation. Programs designed to tax the employer during the time that he hired the individual against the time when he might necessarily let that individual go. We have a United States Employment Service which matches men to job and jobs to men, and which brings together information as to employment opportunities throughout the nation so that men in distressed areas in Warren and in Youngstown and Detroit can know what opportunities are available to them in Southern California, the Southwest, and elsewhere in our nation where times are not so bad. We have a Department of Labor which brings together and analyzes all the pertinent statistics concerning labor and seeks to synthesize from these statistics long-range employment trends, so that school officials, vocational counselors, and the laborer himself can make intelligent determinations and learn the skills which are marketable and saleable in our economy. And finally, with the Employment Act of 1946, became the stated principle of American policy that the federal government was to exert itself to the utmost by pump priming if necessary, to see to it that the highest possible level of employment was sustained. Americans have long recognized that old Talmudic principle. Only the man who eats the fruit of his own labor is happy. We are determined, knowing our bounty, our abundance, to make as many of our polity happy as we can. President Kennedy, recognizing this traditional interest of the American nation in the welfare of the unemployed, has been energetic, determined to mitigate the hardship now existing to get the economy back on its feet. His first executive act on entering office, you will recall, was to broaden and to extend a food subsidy program designed to underwrite and increase the larders of the unemployed in chronic distressed areas. He has since then ordered the cutting of all red tape, projects for which funds have already been allocated, so that the step from drawing board to construction can be hastened. More opportunity, more work will be available in the several communities. He has ordered the quick repayment of income tax rebates and of military insurance dividends, that this money too can filter down into the economy. And he has presented to the Congress a broad social welfare package designed to pump prime the economy, to guarantee to more workers a minimum wage, add to the vocational training and rehabilitation programs already in being, to bring to areas of chronic distress new industry and new opportunity. Now, some have decried this legislative package as another of the creeping tentacles of what they call the welfare state. And it is true. Mr. Kennedy's program to extend unemployment insurance and unemployment insurance itself is welfare legislation. So is the minimum wage law welfare legislation. So is the government's backing of collective bargaining on the part of the unions welfare legislation. If it is a welfare legislation which leads to a welfare state, so be it. Thank God we in America have a government which is concerned with the well-being and the health of all of our citizens. But unfortunately, many of these who decry the welfare state fail to recognize that the government has interfered in the marketplace. That is the essential element of a welfare state. That the government has interfered in the marketplace since the very beginning of our history. The first Congress of the United States passed tariff legislation, import quotas, to protect American business out of concern for the welfare of American business. And from the first Congress to this one, out of concern for the welfare of our corporations, we have had continued tariffs, continuing import quotas, tax laws designed to give the big corporations and the little ones advantage in investment of their capital, depreciation allowances, and actual subsidies for capital outlay and new plants. All this is welfare legislation. All this is an interference with the marketplace. All this is the activity of a welfare state. And not only has our government bestirred itself for big business, but for small business as well. 70 years ago, the government interfered in the marketplace out of concern for the welfare of the small businessman and restricted the monopolies and the cartels and the trusts so that their tentacles could not swallow up those who could not legitimately compete against them. And 30 years ago, out of concern for the farmer, the government again interfered in the welfare, interfered in the marketplace and supported artificially falling farm prices, and these supports have continued till this day. From the very beginning, it has been basic in American history that our government shall be concerned with all the elements of its citizenry. And what these economic primitives fail to recognize is that business or the farm is not the only area of government welfare concern. The government is concerned with the individual citizen, with the worker as well. The government is concerned that the marketplace shall not be loaded against the individual worker. Why must he be the only person who is not protected, who is not given advantages, whose economic life is not sweetened by government support? 30 years or more now since the days of the New Deal, the worker has, of course, been supported. His life has been made easier. And out of this support, out of this welfare legislation, great good has come to all of us. America is the only nation in the world in which there is no labor party, no labor philosophy, no labor radicalism. America is the only nation in the world where the extremes of poverty and wealth have been mitigated, so that the body politic feels itself one. We pull together. We do not pull apart. We are united in common purpose, and not separated by philosophies of the left and philosophies of the right, tearing at the very vitals of our nation. Strangely, despite this traditional welfare concern of the American people, there are some who have attacked Mr. Kennedy's proposals and many who have delayed their passage. Senator Dirksen of Illinois has been the leader in Congress of those who have attacked Mr. Kennedy for crying wolf, for painting too black a picture. They have said that he has been destroying by his somber statements the very confidence which business needs to thrive again. A strange euphoria has settled down over the Potomac, and one suspects that this euphoria comes from senators and congresspeople who read the economic news no further than the stock market pages. Our stock market indices are at record heights. They have been advancing throughout the last several months, and this is good. But the stock market is not the present, but it represents the gamble being made by American citizens on the American future. We have a glorious future, and it is good and it is proper that men should be gambling on that glory. But if we were to set side by side with the Dow Jones Index, an index of human welfare, the lines on this graph would all be downward. Savings have been depleted. Suffering is higher. Men have been dispossessed, thrown out in the streets. Men are suffering. We may choose to drive downtown by Carnegie rather than by Woodland. Out of sight is out of mind. But we cannot deny that in our own city, there are slums and there is poverty and there is suffering. And each week, several hundred people exhaust their unemployment compensation and face a not only jobless, but incomeless future. Each week in our own nation, 25,000 men and women, homemakers, breadwinners, eat up the last of the meager unemployment insurance available to them, and they too join the 600,000 who have no income, who live from handout to handout, whose pride is destroyed by resorting to charity, whose hopes are destroyed by the unavailability of labor, whose frustration breeds only ill for themselves personally, ill for ourselves as a nation. I am afraid that Mr. Dirksen has forgotten a single figure that none of us as Americans should forget. We have moderated, it is true, the extremes of wealth and poverty, but there are still poor among us. 1.6% of all Americans own and control one-third of our total national resources. One-third of all Americans own and control less than 1% of our total national resource. And it is precisely among this, the impoverished third, that there is suffering and that there is hardship now because of unemployment. There is a particular configuration to the unemployment picture today. It has been most severe among men rather than among women. It has been most severe among younger men than against older men, against the Negro than against the white. It has been heaviest in heavy industry, where men are at work. And because of seniority rules and unions, because of the rule that the last hired is the first fired, those who have been left idle are the younger men, those beginning their families, those with the highest expenses and the least capital salted away against the future. And because the Negro is among the newest migratory settlers in our northern industrial centers, one of the last to be hired, one of the last to be admitted to the unions, he has been the most severely hit. One in every seven Negroes in America today is out of work. And what anchor do they have to leeward, most of them? What resources can they fall back on? And what sympathy do they excite in the hearts of our community? There is suffering and there is hardship, and we must not, because we read the stock market pages, close our eyes to that hardship. And we must not behave as have the large corporations, or at least many of their managements, during this period of crisis. I am afraid that Mr. Karl Marx would smile if he could read the record of some of our large industries in the last 18 months. Steel, for 1960, operated at 55% of capacity. Yet corporation after corporation in the steel industry reported the highest, the second highest net profits in its history. Where do these profits come from? Do they come from increased sales? Increased markup of sales? Oh, no. They came from a reduction of human overhead. The steel industry and the automobile industry and the machinery industry together have in 6 months released 900,000 men. Every dividend check sent out by the steel industry represents a paycheck not earned by some worker. And through their lobbies, through the chambers of commerce and the manufacturers' bureaus in Columbus, in Washington, and elsewhere, business has been busy lobbying against the extension of unemployment insurance, or at least the devising of a program of unemployment insurance which will not tax them directly. Unfortunately for business, it has been making much of late of its community responsibilities, of its new moral position. But somehow when it is faced with opportunity in a recessional market, it extracts the human equation and lives only by the code of profit efficiency. Perhaps this is inevitable, but one wonders. One wonders especially when large corporations can retain at full pay men convicted of defrauding our government from upper management during the time of their imprisonment, but cannot find reason to keep at half wages, keep for half shifts, to moderate firing notices, release notices, which are so easily handed out to the labor. I I'm convinced that despite the heel-dragging of business, Kennedy's legislative package will be passed. I am convinced that we will soon begin the upturn of the economic cycle, which will bring this recession to an end, add to the productive output of America, create new jobs, and give us a greater feeling of optimism in the future. But I think we ought to face facts for what they are. Mr. Kennedy, on February 3rd, in reporting to the Congress on the state of our economy, stated these facts quite clearly. He said that even if we have in the spring a quick return to full productivity, we can expect the employment picture to be pretty much what it is today. Throughout this year and perhaps throughout all of next year, 5.5 million Americans, from 6 to 7% of the total labor force, will be out of work. We can expect, therefore, and a greater tax burden will be placed on all of us to continue unemployment insurance programs. Now, there are some who decry these programs. They think of the few indolent who live supposedly in luxury off of them. There are some who are idle, congenitally so. But you cannot live well on the $34 a week, which is the national average, all these unemployment dividends. You certainly cannot live well if you are supporting on that $34 a week a family. If we are determined that the unemployed shall not become unemployable, shall not be driven out into the jungle of the city streets and reduced to human dregs, then we must continue as long as opportunity is not available, these benefits, be it for 39 weeks, be it for 52 weeks, be it for a year or 2 years. America cannot allow a hard core of unemployable, unemployed people to develop. And we must recognize that many of those who have been set free by heavy industry will not be rehired even in times of full production. Of the 900,000 who have been released by the steel, automobile, and machinery industries, less than one-third can expect to get their old jobs back. Factories are now busy automating, bringing in new technological improvements. The very federal program to bring aid to distressed areas by subsidizing loans for new industry in those areas will add to this problem. There are more efficient ways of production than we use in many of our plants today. And when these men come to reapply for work, their work, especially if it was unskilled or semi-skilled, will not be open to them. We have a very serious problem in the long term facing us in America. The whole unemployment picture has changed. No longer is there available to any man who is sufficiently energetic and determined a job. The old Puritan ethic, where there's a will, there's a way. If a man wants to work, he will find work. This has been smashed to smithereens. Work today increasingly demands certain specific skills. A certain competency, literacy, basic judgment, knowledge of electronics, of engineering, what have you. In 1956, for the first time in our history, white-collar workers outnumbered blue-collar workers. From 1950 to 1960, the working population grew by 20%, the number of white-collar jobs multiplied by 38%, the number of unskilled laboring jobs decreased by 1%. A tremendous burden of rehabilitation, employment re-education, training in new vocational skills will have to be undertaken by our federal government and by local organizations, unions, and management together to see to it that those who are sitting idle now in Gary and in Youngstown by our steel mills and Detroit by our automobile factories do not sit for month after month, year after year. And our school systems are faced by this changing unemployment picture with a challenge far more basic and far more dramatic than the challenge of the Sputnik. Sputnik said to the school systems, the brighter academic mind must be trained to a keener edge. The new employment picture says that you cannot release to the labor market each year 800,000 semi-literate, unskilled adolescents. 800,000 adolescents never complete high school, and each year are allowed by minimal state education laws at 14, at 15, at 16 to pour out seeking jobs as elevator operators, as auto mechanics and the like. Increasingly, we will have to demand the high school diploma as the minimum schooling necessary for all of our people. And since many are not capable of the academic elements of that diploma, we will have to cultivate the vocational and technical training fields much more assiduously than we have till now. Not to teach specific skills. Specific skills can quickly be taught on a job. But to equip the young people with a basic understanding of the dimensions of life which surround them. Before the schools can do this job, we, the American public, American parents, must teach our children that they are not being graduated into the world we knew, not into the world that moving pictures tell them about, but into a radically new world, where if they do not have certain specific competences, they will not be able successfully to make their way. Education, dollar per year, is going to be increasingly vital each year as we move into the future. I am not one who is worried by the threat of automation and of technical change. Industrial advance has always meant greater productivity, new industry, and more opportunity. But none of us ought to overlook the short-term problems it presents to those already being employed, must be retrained, to those who may have been employed for 20 and 30 years who cannot be retrained, and whom management must learn to featherbed, harsh, unacceptable though that word be, rather than to throw up their human responsibility and throw them out of jobs. But most of all, we must learn to tell our young people certain simple truths about the world in which they are going to graduate, to see that they do graduate, that they have the basic level of competence which will allow them to make their way. And as a rabbi, as one who believes in voluntary programs far more than governmental programs, as one who believes in personal relationships form far more than in institutional relationships, I would like to see develop in cities like Cleveland a program which I would call Stepping Up the Goals. We have in our center city thousands upon thousands of Puerto Rican children, Negro children, hillbilly children, whose parents not only know nothing of the direction of the American economy, who have no knowledge of the future, but who fear the future, who fear education. It is costly. It may alienate the child from the home. It may train the child far beyond what the society will allow him to do. The brighter of these children must be exposed somehow in some way to the basic dimensions of technical, industrial, and professional and academic life today. I would like to see a big brother, little brother adoptive policy undertaken by our civic organizations, by you and by me. I would like to see us each adopt a young boy or a young girl from some such home and occasionally each week take them with us to our offices, to our business, to lunch, to talk over with them what we are doing, what opportunities are available, the meaning of education, so they do not willy-nilly follow the standards of their peer group, follow the pressures of their parents to earn a few dollars when they are 14 or 15 or 16 to help support the home. Guide these young people to scholarships, to opportunity. Here there is great hope. There are as many brains being wasted in our center city as there are being successfully developed there. Wasted not because the schools are inadequate. They are not. They are excellent schools. Not because the young people are incompetent. They are not. They have excellent, keen minds. Because they simply do not know the opportunities which America can place before them, because they have no guide, no mentor, no parent who can open to them, as you and I perhaps could, the dimensions of tomorrow. But above all else, if we are to solve our problems of unemployment and to mitigate suffering, revive and revitalize the economy, I am convinced that beyond federal legislation and state legislation, all of us in our business relationships, all of the American people who are involved in the financial world must have a change of heart. We must put back the human factor into the business world. We must see to it that when recessions come into being, the corporations do not use the layoff as a golden opportunity to technically change the factory, to reduce human overhead, and to increase profits. Far better lower profits for a year or two, a few more men kept at work, than the burden placed upon the individual and upon his community by idleness. I have not seen during the past year many corporation executives being released, nor have I seen many corporation executives bringing home reduced paychecks. And yet I have seen one in every five Americans who are at work working less than 35 hours a week. I have seen the average work week for the worker drop from 40.2 hours to 38 hours. I have seen 1,750,000 Americans thrown out of work. I have seen 1,500,000 more Americans enter a labor market which has little opportunity for them. And seeing this, I recognize that no governmental policy can completely solve this equation. That business people, office managers and the like must make not only business decisions, but human decisions. That all of us must find work, keep it work, and if necessary, make work. And if we do, then I am convinced we will continue great up the surge of American prosperity which has been ours for the past 20 years. There's an old Talmudic expression that a man who has no work dies. He withers within. He becomes less than a man. He has no outlet for his dignity, for his self-respect. He loses face with his family. He loses face in his community. And when he is out of work through no fault of his own, because of the contortions of an economic cycle which he in no way affects, his frustration not only leads to anger, but leads to a personal disorientation. It leads to a loss of self-respect. He becomes less of a man. We wish this fate for no man, and not wishing it, we are determined each to do our share, to see the highest possible level of employment is provided by us in our businesses, by our government through its programs, for all the workers of our nation.